Yeah, welcome to the Anarchist Book Club with Jim Yeoman and me, Danny Evans. In this episode, we talk about Jim's book, Print Culture and the Formation of the Anarchist Movement in Spain, 1890 to 1915, which is out already in the US through AK Press and will shortly be available elsewhere. Jim's book tells the story of the Spanish anarchist movement during crucial years of its development over the turn of the 20th century, focusing on the hundreds of newspapers that were established and sustained by groups and networks both in Spain and beyond. For an overview of the book's subject matter, I highly recommend the interview that Jim did with the Coffee with Comrades podcast back in October. To avoid repeating the content of that episode, our conversation focuses on some of the key themes of Jim's book, such as violence, gender and organisation, in order to discuss both its findings and implications. We really enjoyed this conversation and we hope you do too. Before we begin, I'm going to read a poem sent to us by Ryan Roberts, one of the Kill the Bill prisoners. For more information on the Kill the Bill prisoners and how to write to them, please check out Bristol Defendant Solidarity or Bristol ABC. The poem is called Community. Community is an area we are all in, not just a label given by councils or government within. It's about coming together, barriers now we can break, building common foundations, identities no one can take. Bonds created through unity, resilience formed so strong, ensuring we combine to identify where we belong. Accepting diversity allows a common ground, age, gender, religion, no one will be beaten down. Becoming one and allowing care and consideration in facing trials and tribulations brings everyone elation. Life expectations shared give guidance and direction, not able to be bought or sold, only open to perception. Our community is our belief, a future we all want, working with a purpose to bring us together. That's our community, no one can beat. All right, Jim. So we're going to be using your book as the starting point for the discussion today. I thought we could start off by talking about violence. So violence is something that's often associated with anarchism in a very stupid and flippant kind of way. Your book helps us get beyond that, not only by looking at different anarchist attitudes towards violence, but also looking at differences within violence itself, which I think is like really important, because often like when violence gets written about in history, it seems like it's often in a kind of like homogenous and undifferentiated way, even though it's like kind of obvious that not just to anarchists, but to anyone, that there is a big difference between, say, throwing a bomb into a crowd of people and targeted assassination or violence during pickets and things like this. So I think that's something that you bring across pretty well in your book, that there's not, you know, we don't just talk about the anarchist movement as being differentiated in terms of its attitude towards violence, but also the different types of violence and different types of attitudes that anarchists might have towards them. So I don't know if you wanted to come back on that. Is that something that like stood out to you in your own research?
When it was kind of becoming clear that my work, that, you know, this came out of my PhD thesis, this book, you know, was going to focus in on this period around the turn of the 19th and 20th century, I guess if I kind of naively thinking I could maybe just not talk about anarchist terrorism, because essentially for that period, that's where so much of the historiography rests on, that I suggested starting in like 1900, you know, kind of after the real peak of anarchist terrorism. And I'm glad that I was kind of advised that, no, you need to talk about this. It's important. And you've probably got something interesting to say. And I'm pleased to hear that you think that I did. Because, I mean, as with almost every theme that comes out in the book, but I think it is quite acute on violence, there's such a plurality, and as you say, there's almost kind of pluralities within pluralities of kind of what anarchists are thinking. And so when I'm there reading all the different papers and all the different perspectives on all the different types and theories and events which contain forms of violence, and I'm trying to think about it. It really quite starkly contrasted with most of the historiography I was reading of the period. Now, there are some extremely, you know, sophisticated writers on anarchist propaganda by the deed. Constance Bantman, who's been on the podcast, you know, writes very well about it. There are others for different countries. I don't want to totally sort of disparage that historiography. But on the Spanish movement, there is, you know, there is a tendency either because of the paucity of sources, which is one reason for it, you know, those that rely on official sources like police sources and so on just created a wholly different picture of what was going on and why it was going on and what anarchists thought about it. And it did really seem to be something that I could say that, you know, that was new about it. And to do that, I think I had to start where, like, lots and lots of these discussions within the movement started, which is to think about violence in a very multifaceted way, to align that with existing thoughts that anarchists had about violence up to the start of terrorism or propaganda by the deed campaigns, and then see how that interacted with the reality of it when it was actually happening in Spain and what then happened. And, you know, as I said, it's a common occurrence in the book, but, you know, if someone wanted to read it, the chapter on violence, and come away and say, well, anarchists, you know, all supported bombing, you know, public Catholic processions, or, you know, anarchists were, you know, supportive of terrorism in this decade, which would be one way to summarize it, but it just, you're not going to get something like that from this chapter, I'm afraid. You're going to have to accept that that isn't accurate, and the reality is much more nuanced. But nor is it true to say they didn't, which is the response of some more kind of, you know, sympathetic authors. Like, they obviously did, or some did, and that's worth exploring too, and how those things intermeshed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this, I mean, it's something that continues, even though, like, obviously your book looks at, like, that turn of the century period, the classic sort of era of propaganda by the deed, or, like, you know, spectacular anarchist terrorism. But anarchists, well, what would be called by state authorities anarchist terrorism persisted insofar as, like, targeted assassinations and things like that continued to be associated with the movement, obviously in Spain in the years of the 1920s and in the years of Pistolerismo, often obviously in retaliation to a sort of armed defences by the employers starting off in Barcelona. I think, like, divisions still remain, but what also persisted was this, like, understanding that violence came in different forms, and that what gets called terrorism by the authorities might be seen as justified or not according to totally different criteria by anarchists depending on the circumstances.
I mean, you see that most acutely, I guess, in two episodes in the 1890s, that, you know, one, it's kind of always framed as, like, the worst attack. I mean, I've got no way what kind of barometer people are using to judge that, but the bombing of the Corpus Christi procession in Barcelona, that provokes one of the clearest rejections of this kind of behavior that I saw, you know, in any of the sources. This headline, you know, statement from the by far the most important paper in the movement at the time, La Idea Libre, that says, look, absolutely not. We're not, like, this isn't anything to do with this. It violates our theory and so on. And that is just one perspective, and there were others, but, and that is this one type of violence, this the bombing of a completely public place. There was no targeted element to it. Presumably the thought was, as was with some similar attacks, that outrage would prompt revolution. Presumably the culprit was never really found for this, so it's very hard to talk about motives and so on. Presumably there was a symbolic significance in bombing a Catholic procession, given the antagonism with the Catholic Church, and they're seen as complicity with the repression which was going on in Barcelona. Nevertheless, I think that, you know, to have basically some of the most prominent figures in the movement saying, if this is anarchism, then we're not anarchists. So that there's that kind of strength. But then a couple of years later, you have the assassination of Prime Minister Conobasto Castillo, seen by many as the architect of the most intense repression of the movement in this era. And no one, I mean, this goes beyond the anarchist movement, but certainly within the anarchist movement, that is not seen as even controversial, that was justified. And so, again, that brings you back, like, how can you have a sweeping statement to say that anarchists are pacifist or anarchists are, you know, violent, or, you know, it's all about that negotiation of some principles or some ways of approaching life and the way you think about it and amongst other people, and then the reality of it. I mean, I guess one thing, again, which does kind of separate what I've been doing from some of the other kind of works, is I'm not particularly interested in the perpetrators of these attacks. I don't look to tell their story or psychoanalyze them, as sometimes happens, or, you know, try and explain their actions through the ideology. Firstly, because there's, to me anyway, there isn't really enough evidence by far to do that kind of exploration. I'm not particularly interested in terrorist history, I guess is how you call it, or the history of in that way. What I'm interested in, as I've said, is what did an anarchist on the other side of Spain think about this and what it meant for them in their lives, and how did they discuss that and how did they turn it around? You know, I'd be interested, you brought up kind of later periods where kind of similar things have happened. Did you see, you're more familiar with, you know, the 20s and 30s than I am. I mean, are there echoes in those kind of debates? Is it, my kind of suspicion is that it's a less prominent feature of the movement because there are other things happening. So it's not necessarily dominating the conversations as it was in the 1890s, but it'd be interesting to know.
Like, I don't know too much about the 20s. It's something I'm like only just starting to scratch the surface of, really. But the impression I get is that like a certain type of targeted violence of like specific individuals who are thought to be damaging to the workers' movement, either broadly or, you know, in specific conflicts, is accepted as a part of the repertoire of tactics and resources that the broader anarchist movement can draw on. I think like what's interesting about the period you're looking at is that the anarchist movement is in a state of transition where different ideas, different strategies seem to be being addressed and debated at any given time. Whereas the period that I'm looking at, you know, the CNT is the sort of epicenter of the entire movement. So a lot of the debate would not be so much about, you know, the rights and wrongs in terms of the anarchist ideal of, like, say, killing, you know, a chief of police or whoever it might be. It would be like, you know, the extent to which the CNT, the organization, is potentially damaged or benefited as a result of it. And so, like, you see like anarchist violence being written about in the history books in relation to internal disputes within the CNT, but it's not always that convincing because, you know, like famously more moderate leading figures within the CNT would want to distance themselves from, say, groups of, you know, action groups going out and robbing banks and people getting killed in those kinds of activities. But then there is evidence to suggest that they, like, you know, those same people give a nod and a wink to action groups when they go out to kill, you know, specific like enemies of the CNT and so forth. So it's like, I think in the same way as your book is something that you can't like draw hard and fast lines around in terms of like a particularly an undifferentiated attitude towards violence. But I think that as distinct from the period you're looking at, that the CNT, like the size and importance of the CNT to all of the like anarchist world in Spain in that period does give a different inflection to how like violence is considered, and also a sort of tacit understanding of like who would be responsible for carrying out that kind of violence. So, you know, those same like sort of action groups who might be useful to or seen as like certainly defensible by CNT bigwigs when they're killing like specific like leaders of the police and things like that in Barcelona, for example, that's kind of activity was probably more prominent. You know, that those same people would be potentially a problem for the more moderate leadership when they were either bringing like unnecessary or seen as bringing unnecessary repression or police attention to the movement, or getting involved in activities that the CNT leadership felt was like unbecoming, you know, like not something they wanted the movement to be associated with. So I think that, yeah, there's that sort of overlap, but there is a difference. And I think there is, like, particularly among kind of mid-level activists, a sort of consensus that in certain circumstances, these kinds of like targeted violence is a part of our repertoire. By that point, the insofar as like propaganda of the deed persisted as a way of thinking, it wasn't associated with individual spectacular acts of violence, but with like insurrections, you know, that were like perhaps artificially started, you know, inorganically like declared as going to start on a particular day, and like in the hope, you know, I think that's also in a tradition of like perhaps of more classical anarchist thinkers as well, that, you know, you go to a certain area, you try and start an insurrection, and then you see like, you know, the extent to which that has reverberations, you know. That was definitely like a part of like a certain way of anarchist thinking in the 30s, and that it would, you know, that had certainly superseded the spectacular sort of terroristic acts, but which, you know, again, were similar sort of points of contention. That, I mean, like insofar as like what type of violence, when, how is it useful, remained a kind of ongoing live debate within the movement. It would be more associated with that, you know, like the pre-planned insurrection kind of thing, as opposed to like individual terroristic acts, you know, which were decentered, I suppose, as actions that the movement was involved in.
That's interesting, because that's, you know, the first kind of example in this era that I talk about is the uprising in Jerez in 1892 in southern Spain. Long debates as to whether that was kind of pre-planned or, you know, structured. I kind of hedge my bets a bit in my analysis of it, basically because the evidence isn't strong enough to give a case either way. But that seems much more, there seems to be much more resonance there with those 1930s, like Casas Viejas and things like that. And it's interesting that in most studies, Jerez is excluded from this period, from this theme of that, because it's not that targeted assassination or public indiscriminate, you know, broad acts of violence. It's not included in this idea of propaganda of the deed. So it's interesting. Whereas it does seem like there are greater differences then, you know, with something like the Pistolerismo period that you discussed there. And I think that reflects, as you said, the state of the movement. You know, in the 1890s, the movement is in complete schism. It's lost most of its support within organized labor. It's feeling slightly adrift. And when then someone who calls himself an anarchist throws a bomb into an opera house, there isn't this question of what does that mean for the structure of the movement or the main, you know, because there isn't one. Like, there is on a smaller level, but there isn't anything comparable to the CNT. And in a sense, it becomes much more of an existential question about what is this in reflection of me, I guess, as an anarchist, or our theory, or is this a strategy to, and this was the belief, it was a strategy for bringing forward the revolution, whereas it doesn't sound like the kind of executions of bosses was ever conceived of as something that was going to bring about the, it feels more like the CNT is going to be the vehicle for the revolution. This is a part of that process, rather than this act will open the eyes of the people and their will. And again, this is why I start with the theory. Like, it does come out of this particular brand of what's called anarcho-communism, which in the 19th century rejects really the relationship with unions and organized labor, and, you know, is much more about individual action or small group action. And I guess that's one of the ways that they square that circle of, like, you know, so how are you going to bring about the revolution? And there is it's not an exact fit, but it's much closer than that is anarcho-collectivism, which is the other major tendency, which is much, much more kind of union orientated. And those papers tend to be the, you know, understandably the least supportive of this kind of action. So it does fit. It sounds like there's similarities and also quite strong differences really between the two. And presumably as well, you know, the people in the movement in the 20s and 30s would have known their history. They would have known what was going on in the 1890s. They would have heard stories. They would have read books about it. You know, the reprints of books that come out the first time in the 1890s, they're coming out throughout. So, you know, presumably they knew that, like, you know, what the movement had been through then, what and drawn presumably different lessons from it, but it's still, you know, it's not like it's they're starting afresh completely from these ideas.
And I mean, there's also like in terms of like those doctrinal disputes between anarcho-communist and anarcho-collectivist, I'm not really sure about like sort of how and when this happens. And maybe it's something that's kind of being cleared up by Myrtle, the hymnologue in the, I think it's like three volumes that's out in French at the moment and is being translated into Spanish. And the first volume's out. It's called Los Caminos del Comunismo Libertario. So it's like the pathways of libertarian communism. I mean, it'd be brilliant, I think, if that were to be translated into English at some point. She goes into those kinds of doctrinal disputes within the anarchist movement, but less so in relation to violence. And I suppose, like, once, I mean, like, ultimately, the CNT is committed to libertarian communism. It's like vision of anarchism, you know, insofar as there's consensus around it, more closely approximates like a communist tradition than a collectivist one, you know, even though like there are I think blurred lines really, residues of each tradition as they get enacted or practiced in some areas. It's so it seems like you could think about the 1890s, that sort of initial anarcho-communist confusion or sympathy for like individual acts of terrorism is about like the inability to influence the workers' movement at that point, and that obviously enters a new phase later on. And perhaps like you know the interview we had with Arturo is relevant there because the Russian Revolution obviously introduces a new way of understanding possibilities for violence as you know collective class kind of revenge as opposed to like individualized, because you know a lot of those acts of terrorism were considered themselves to be acts of vengeance. But you get like this from 1917, you perhaps have this different understanding of how vengeance might be enacted on a kind of collective sort of scale. So yeah, I don't think this is something that like we could like necessarily resolve or provide easy answers to, but I think that you know that there's a lot of interest there. One thing I wanted to pick up on was what you said about like the Corpus Christi bombing and the anti-clericalism, because obviously anti-clerical violence was also like something that would just remained a part of the repertoire of protest within Spain more broadly, and not even not only just not solely within the anarchist movement, but not even within like working class movements. It belongs to like a kind of broader, I don't know if you call it a progressive Republican tradition, into which like you know anarchism you know, overlapped in certain places, but which you'd also think about like socialism, communism, and I suppose if you're thinking about Spanish anarchist violence, probably it's violence against priests during the Civil War, that it would like be the most like infamous kind of example, even though it's like it's quite lazy to attribute it to anarchist like wholesale. But I did think that there was an interesting observation in your book where you talk about violence during the so-called Tragic Week in Barcelona in 1909, where like largely working class riots also involved like multiple churches being set on fire. And there's an observation towards the end of your book after you've like discussed it in more detail early on, where you talk about how sort of class a kind of class momentum had been dissipated through anti-clerical violence, which I thought was like a really interesting observation. And maybe this idea that the way that like a sort of like working class autonomy, once it gets channeled into like a kind of specific set of violent practices against the church sort of then weaves itself into like a kind of broader declassed kind of anti-Catholic kind of violence. I don't know, is that something that you've like thought more about since writing the book, or is it it's obviously like quite complicated because obviously like hatred of the church was like was a class issue in Spain, and you know the church itself was an actor in you know in terms of like the maintenance of the social hierarchy, but also in terms of like land ownership and wealth and things like that. So it's like perfectly understandable that aspect of like that dynamic. But the very fact that anti-clericalism was a kind of cross-class movement in Spain, you know, is there a way of like seeing that, like, you know, that by channeling that
working class violence or working class momentum or movement into like sort of narrow and anti-religious kind of channels, that class aspect was diluted or dissipated.
There's a decent argument to be made there. I wouldn't go as far as to say it was. I mean, Joan Ullman kind of does. That's one of the major points of her kind of brilliant study of the Tragic Week, and I maybe wouldn't go as far as saying that. It's happening at the same time that Solidaridad Obrera, the precursor to the CNT, is coalescing. It's already expanded across Catalonia, and it's just making its first steps into trying to become a national federation of syndicalists, one which appeals largely to the anarchist movement, particularly outside Catalonia. And you know, in a way, like they would say, I think in not so many words, what that kind of thesis that this, you know, once it was going on, they were involved, they were on, you know, they were part of discussions about the initial kind of uprisings against conscription, which I guess is another channel for cross-class action in Spain as well, rejection of the military and imperial ventures. But they move on extremely quickly afterwards, and they don't try and say, like, this was a good idea. This was a, you know, this is something which forwards the cause of the working class. I mean, very few anarchist papers do really claim the Tragic Week or anti-clerical violence of that nature explicitly. Now, that could be covering their back, but I'm always slightly wary of that kind of argument because, again, from my point of view, from my interest, the same argument is made about why more papers don't vocally or support terrorism in the 1890s, that they're covering their back, they don't want to get closed down. Well, that may be the case, again, if we're interested in particular individuals making editorial decisions, but nevertheless, if we're looking at it from a wider point of view, from the whole movement, that is what the discourse was saying. So, like it or not, that's what the anarchist line was. So if I'm picking up a paper in Gijón trying to read about the Tragic Week, this is the interpretation that I'm getting from the anarchist movement, which is hedging, really, about the point of the Tragic Week, the point of anti-clerical violence in that way. It's not equivocal and certainly doesn't seem like it bears repeating. What people are being instructed to do is join with their fellow workers, is to propagate the anarchist idea, is to, you know, so maybe they do, you know, they do see it as a slightly like a pressure valve that they don't want opened all the time. And an interesting point, I think, as well to compare is, so 2 years later, again, kind of right at this moment, this is when the CNT is actually formed in 1911, formed by name in 1911, happens at exactly the same time that there's a big strike wave across Spain, the first, real major strike wave on a sort of national scale, happens at the time that the Congress of the CNT is going on. And there really isn't anything like the anti-clerical violence that you see in the Tragic Week, but there is some in Valencia. It's not even that isn't even considered a part of, you know, this whole wider strike move. You know, that's the story of the day. That's the thing. And again, it ties in the CNT is then repressed, but it that is very in contrast, I guess, to the aftermath of the Tragic Week, that is seen as like that was legitimate, that was useful behavior, that was class action, some of it by anarchists, but more broadly, I think it was a working class movement. I don't think either the socialists or anarchists could claim that it was their idea. So I think it's always interesting to two kind of comparable events. Just very quickly to circle back a little bit. It's interesting you brought it up, the attack on the Corpus Christi procession in relation to anti-clericalism, because I certainly don't draw a line between those two things in that way, and I don't know any studies of anti-clericalism that do. I might be wrong. I've never seen it framed as an anti-clerical incident in Spain as an example of it, and I don't know if that's because the person who did it was never really fully established. It's always kind of framed more broadly as it was. I think most people assume it was an anarchist, including the movement itself assumes it was an anarchist, and therefore would have these ideas. but it's not generally written into the history of anti-clerical. And I mean, again, maybe because most of the people who died weren't priests, or it wasn't church property that was destroyed. It was a public religious event. So most of the people who died were bystanders. So it's interesting, and it would be interesting to maybe kind of frame it in that pretty rich, you know, historical study on anti-clericalism.
Perhaps we could like try and move away from violence a bit, but like one of the sort of justifications for anti-clericalism in the anarchist movement and more broadly was its specifically gendered dynamics, or the assumption that women in particular were kept beholden to the priests. At the beginning of the Civil War was that Federica Monsenni, the famous woman anarchist, gave a speech in which he said, "Woman, you are no longer the priest's concubine." So like this idea that women in general were, in a highly Catholic country, as well as a highly anti-clerical country, it was women who were more likely to be under the thumb of the local priest, more likely to be influenced by them in terms of ideas, more likely to be cowed by fear of hell, punishment, religious shaming, things like this, than men were. You know, there's even certain like kind of macho or like male hero kind of like readings of, you know, convents being taken over and things like that during the beginning of the Civil War, where it's like, you know, nuns are being liberated from you know, this assumption that they are being held there, you know, effectively against their will, or like as kind of captives of the Catholic Church. So that brings us on, I suppose, to how anarchists thought about gender. Again, it's like something that you go into in quite a lot of detail in your book. And again, the picture is like from looking at the press, it's not like clear that there's like one particular line or consensus, or insofar as there is consensus, it's not necessarily like consistently thought through, like how like equality for women is going to be enacted either before or after the revolution within the anarchist movement. And I think that's something that really does persist, even you know, looking at like anarchist print culture in the Civil War and things like that. It's something that you could pick up on definite contradictions there then as well.
One of the things that I kind of miss about research, I guess, is when you're seeing thoughts or arguments kind of develop out of the sources as you're reading them. And one of them is this, you know, there is a clear marked shift in the content of anarchist papers from, you know, from the 1890s and the early 20th century to the amount of space given to even just opening up the discussion of gender, sexual emancipation, equality, all those questions. Like, it's just not a topic of conversation, or like it's maybe given some lip service occasionally beforehand, but just to see it again and like popping up often, it might be the same article reprinted across loads of papers, but that's a finding. That's interesting that these things are, it's clearly entering the discourse. By no means is it the dominant feature of the time, of the kind of the very early 20th century, but it's worth focusing in on, because so much, I guess, of what we talk about and think about, you know, in regards to anarchist relations to sex and gender, you know, rightly comes from study of largely the 1930s onwards, I would say, certain publications which focus on it a lot, you know, and there's some really good work on that. But in the kind of broader sense that I'm looking at it, those very few and very committed theorists and writers, people like Teresa Claremont and Federica Monsenni's mother, Soledad Gustavo, really start, this is when they really start pushing out that literature, trying to get it within the remit of anarchism, which ties into this much broader idea of cultural resurgence within the movement, which follows this period of violence. Again, you're right to link that to the church, because, you know, one aspect of the violence of the world, of the state, of capitalism is the very physical violence, the policeman who represses you. Then it's the church's violence is that which keeps you in ignorance. And as you say, more often than not, that's seen in gendered terms, that it's seen as women that are repressed that way. You know, if the boss represses the male, then it's the priest that's repressing the female and the child, who are often kind of bound together in that sense. But one of the more kind of obvious parts of this, or the other ways that that strikes you out, is in this discussion of education, which again centers on women often. You know, Spain has very high illiteracy rates at this time, but they're much, much higher amongst women than they are men. And again, it's seen, they're seen as a body of people. Again, not too dissimilar to what we're talking about with violence in a way. It could be accused of being naive, but I actually kind of quite like it in some way. The idea that if you, there are so many ignorant, no, they would use that word, there are so many ignorant people, there are so many illiterate people, particularly women, particularly children. It's a belief in human reason that, you know, they think if only these people were educated properly, they would see that anarchism is the truth, and therefore, you know, carry out the revolution. Basically, if only we can do that, you know, almost like the idea, if you throw a bomb into the theater, people will see, because then we don't have to tell them to do it or make them do it, which is always the concern. So again, women seen as this massive kind of body of people who could be brought to the truth in that way. One of the ways this stands out is it is with, you know, anarchist education projects like Francisco Ferrer's Modern School, by far the most scandalous thing in Spain. And the thing as well that many anarchists felt was the most important part of that, and with similar projects, was the co-education of sexes. And that isn't something that really resonates that much nowadays. We kind of, well, yeah, of course. Like, you know, why wouldn't boys and girls go to school together? But that was by far the most scandalous thing that Ferrer was doing. Like, that's the thing that got the headlines. They're going to school, like, boys and girls going to school together, you know, because it's just not, that is the world that they were in. It's not possible, you know, in Spanish society, to imagine that men and women can learn the same things, can perform the same roles in society, that have the same value and worth. And that does, that is for them, for the movement, and I think it's probably true, that's rooted in the church and its attitude to how it controls the education system.
Like, one of the things that's interesting is like that idea, like that exposure to reason, like if only people would be exposed to, you know, a rational way of understanding the world, and then there'd be anarchists effectively, is also reflective, I think, of like how for many like people who became activists, or many people who became like anarchists, there was a literal overlap between anarchism and learning, because like that was their exposure to literacy. Like if you know a lot of like people who had very minimal schooling or perhaps no schooling at all and go to work very, very young, you know, their first like exposure to the power of print or the power of literacy, like, you know, why it's worth reading, is through hearing people reading anarchist newspapers. And it's basically impossible to imagine the impact that would have on an individual, but it doesn't take too much imagination to realize that it would be extremely profound, you know, and that it seems like far less naive, particularly when there are like so much fewer competing like voices, you know, within like a given like sort of workplace, in terms of like, you know, presenting a way of explaining the world, that people would think that, yes, you know, like there is like a sort of literal equivalence between a rational viewpoint and an anarchist worldview.
I don't mean naive in that like this would result in that if you teach people how to read through anarchist literature, you know, or if you teach economics through a discussion of why capitalism is awful, or, you know, those kind of, in a way, like, part of me is kind of, I guess, cynical, and be like, well, of course they're then going to see the reason of anarchism. And this is a point of discussion and controversy in the movement, is, you know, are we indoctrinating people? But it's not really, that comes up within a few circles. But generally, when they're saying reason and truth and objectivity, they mean following anarchist ideas. It, like, they are synonymous. So fair enough.
It's true.
I see that that's up for debate, but I'm not criticizing. It's not a criticism. It's just, it is interesting though that no other movement is this bothered about these people learning how to read, or learning about all manner of things that they bring into these discussions, like geography or, you know, chemistry, you know, like they talk about all these things, and you can't imagine that this is the first time that you're going to be exposed to this stuff is through the local paper that's put together by like four Coopers down the road. It's incredible. I just think the idea that that isn't going to be the necessary outcome of it, and they certainly weren't, like, you know, like they weren't saying, and they weren't going about it cynically, I don't think. They weren't, you know, they were, this wasn't like, we need to overhaul the education system so that we can indoctrinate people into anarchism. But, you know, yeah, it turns out if you educate people through that particular prism, it's going to happen. And wouldn't that be a better place?
The thing that when you like think about like gender within that, I do think it potentially complicates it a bit, because you have this assumption by, you know, enlightened male anarchists that women are more likely to be ignorant because of the church. Then how to like then square like women's autonomy and women's emancipation with like the male's assumption of a role of education, you know, and the requirement of the male to like liberate these women kept like sort of captive to ignorance by the church. And I think that, I mean, something that I've like come across recently, and I'm not sure how true this is, and I don't want to name names or anything, but like speaking to like relatives, like children of anarchists in Spain, I mean, it's quite common that you'll see women who are known by names like, you know, Natura or Armonia or Vida, you know, like words that aren't like normally names, and at the time, like, by being non-religious words associated with the natural world, you know, just wouldn't be like, people wouldn't be baptized like that. But they're very common among anarchists, and lots of like kids would be named, were given those names. What would also happen is that like women would take on those names, like, you know, they'd call themselves Libertad or something like that. But from speaking to people, it seems as though there is, or like at least among the kids, there's a perception that their dads effectively named their mums. You know, their dads effectively like rebaptized their mums with names that they thought were more appropriate according to their own ideology. It's like obviously something where you'd really need to speak to the individuals concerned, or like read their accounts of it in letters or things like that, to like sort of get to grips with it. Because there is definitely a sense of like women, you know, emancipating themselves through anarchism, just in the same way as there is for men. But there is also another dynamic by which men who have been exposed to anarchism then, you know, feel like it's appropriate for the partners to have the same outlook as them, at least on the surface. And, you know, how that actually happened, I think, well, we can only speculate. You could imagine that it took different forms in different circumstances. But that possibly, and this is something that comes across in through reading the articles as well, is that the critique of like gender inequality probably hadn't been sufficiently thought through for there to be self-criticism among the men, like trying to quote unquote liberate their own partners.
No, there wasn't. Like, I don't think many, the you know, some men do write quite a lot about sex and gender and the roles of men and women. I don't think, like you said, I don't think they've quite reached the point of reflecting on themselves and what they're doing in relation to that.
A lot of it's like, women shouldn't, you should be like me, you should be better, you should go to meetings.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Like, women, educate yourselves. But also, I mean, it was interesting the quote from Monseigneur as well that you brought up earlier, because that's also what female activists do as well. Like, they're perhaps more critical of women, you know, like this assumption that women are ignorant, like, you are ignorant, so listen to me and do it. And like you said, it just hasn't, I don't think that the discourse on this area has reached that point where, certainly nothing like what you get with Mujeres Libres' is, you know, critique of the movement, which to me seems to be one of the most valuable things they did, with pushing that into the movement more. It's a step up from, they had from inception seen themselves, which is, again, you think we're thinking about the times here, like, quite a lot. We're being clear about when we're talking about this, because the movement changes a lot over 70 years. When it first started, though, totally unique in Spain, you know, anarchism, the anarchist movement declares things like gender equality to be its goal. Now, it does literally nothing about that. But, you know, that in the mid-19th century, that is, yeah, it's worthy of comment that they're doing that. By this point, they're just starting to think, well, how, well, what does that mean? How do we do that? What? And it comes in at a point they are endlessly getting tangled up in a way about how you do it. How do we do these things? How do we bring it about without making people do it? And then it seems like every time they make a step forward, they realize actually there's a whole other layer of ways that people are made to do things. You know, like, if okay, so, you know, women need to be liberated. Let's help them do that. Well, actually, hang on, we're then, you know, projecting onto them. So then we need to, you know, and it happens. It's certainly not just with this question. It happens with almost every kind of strategy they bring up is, we've encountered the fact that we're doing that again, aren't we, guys? Like, we're
and obviously we know that from our own lives as well, don't we? Like, our own, like, you know, it's something that you constantly come up against the limitations of your own experience, your own subjective understanding, and your own, like, knowledge.
And I think, I mean, one of the strengths and one of the reasons why it's so interesting is that they're very rarely, I think, I don't know, you tell me if it comes about more often later on, but then upon encountering these limits, they go, all right, so let's now explore that more, and try, they don't just say, just shut up and listen to, like, this party newspaper. Obviously there are limits to it, obviously it's constantly in flux, but debates are taken seriously, which is more than can be said for example the socialist movement in Spain at this time, which is the kind of, it's almost a parody of rigidity and, like, don't bring up kind of ideology or questions of practice.
It brings up, like, another, like, difference between, you know, our periods, you know, the areas that we're most, like, well versed in, and that, you know, but by the time of the 1930s, the CNT, well, the Spanish movement, definitely had a sense of its own exceptionalism vis-a-vis the rest of the world's labor movements and you know, the socialist movement more broadly. Whereas, like, in your period, I mean, like, you can tell me if this is true, like, but the very fact that, like, we, you know, we'd have to think about anarchism as a transnational movement. You also have, like, these quite extraordinary women activists who are becoming fairly prominent at the beginning of the 20th century, whether it's, like, Emma Goldman, Volturnia de Clara, and people like that. But also you have, like, a women's anarchist newspaper at the turn of the century in Argentina, don't you? Voz de la Mujer. So I don't know if, like, do you get a sense of, like, those kind of impulses? I mean, obviously the example that you go into in like, quite a lot of detail with the book, because it's so, like, pivotal for the movement more broadly, is, like, French syndicalism's influence within Spain. But do you get a sense that, like, that part of, like, this renovation of anarchism in Spain in the early years of the 20th century has to do with that, like, those kinds of, like, winds blowing in from elsewhere?
Yeah, always. None of what's going on in Spain, I think, is, or anywhere, to be honest, is that, what's the term, like, sui generis, like, you know, like, it comes, you know, it's constantly cross-pollinating. I mean, Martha Ackersberg's written that great article on comparing this kind of era feminist publishing in Spain and Argentina, and there is a paper launched in Spain after the Argentinian one called La Humanidad Libre. It's really interesting. On their front page, they have a list of all the supporters, and it's kind of like that list of names that you read out. You know, it's like all the prominent female radical libertarian activists you can think of around the world. I doubt many of them were actually contacted and you know, kind of said, but that, in a way, that was their way of saying that this is beyond us. You know, there's the kind of Spanish ones, but there's also Emma Goldman. There's a couple of names that I've actually not been able to find any info on, but they must have been, you know, kind of prominent. There's an Italian socialist feminist listed there. So yeah, certainly. And it goes beyond, obviously, this question. You know, I make a clearer discussion of it when I talk about syndicalism. More or less all of these, you know, developments are coming in through out of Spain, you know, again, and what they're doing impacts elsewhere. Particularly, and this is something that I think I try and emphasize, but there isn't really that much work on it. Again, to my knowledge, I'm not well versed in French historiography, but it's particularly France. Like if things are going on in France, they're seen as that's kind of legit. That's the movement that we should be following, which is interesting then given the subsequent histories. And like you say, where the CNT ends up as this kind of lighthouse for anarchism around the world, they at this time are very much seeing themselves as being in the shadow of France. Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to talking about the newspapers themselves and who's producing them. One thing that I find trying to get my head around what was going on in the sort of period after your book finishes was basically trying to see if there is a way of distinguishing between newspapers and affinity groups that have the same name in an area. You talk about how what you call propaganda groups are often associated with newspapers. I mean, was it something that you were able to pass effectively, or do you think it's just the fact that a lot of the key sorts of affinity groups in Spain, one of the main things they did was produce a newspaper?
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, the kind of scheme that I eventually sort of settled on is in a local area, people will kind of get together, and it may be through a union, or it may be kind of like-minded people, and they, at this point, particularly without any sort of national overhanging structure, they may decide that the best way that they can forward the movement is through propaganda, and they will form a propaganda group. Now, as that develops, they may well attach themselves to a newspaper that exists, to a periodical that is already in publishing, and they may well unhelpfully call themselves the same name, and then they will act as the distributors of that paper in the local area. They might read it to people, sell it, send money back, those kind of things. Really, where many of them are aiming for is publishing their own one. And that, again, I think, speaking afterwards, this is a less common ultimate goal. But I would think so many of these groups obviously are set up with the intention of doing this, of putting a paper together, that it is one of the main activities. And this is something I try and stress, at the start of the book, that it's a false distinction between doing stuff and making a newspaper. The texts and actions are somehow separate, because at this point, making a newspaper together is what you would do. There isn't that much else in some ways. There wasn't the outlets. You couldn't join the CNT. You couldn't, you could maybe teach. That would then bring you into really close contact with print culture. You could, you'd be in a union. Well, the only way you're going to hear about any other unions that think remotely similarly is through the anarchist press. So you might want to set up your own anarchist newspaper to communicate that to people. It's an end goal of these groups. My impression is that does wane after the period that I'm talking about. I hope so, because it's kind of a justification for why I stopped it when I did around 1915. That with the, the growing consolidation of the CNT, the growing prominence of its daily newspaper by this point, that in some ways having that as your end goal is less important than it was previously. But it's not easy. Not least as well, because the only information really we have on these groups and what they're doing is through the press, which is usually quite piecemeal. So the only way I've been able to kind of even come up with this fairly broad scheme about how it's working is through basically the volume of very, very short bits of information that they give to the newspaper, and just trying to kind of consider it all coming, putting together. And then looking at future comparable groups and how they've operated in, that are better studied. There's more kind of memoirs about activity in later period, and then just kind of inferring that that's what would have been going on years before.
I mean, I think that there is a rupture, but there are also continuities in terms of that kind of anarchist practice and its relationship to affinity group. And I think you're totally justified in ending the book where you do. And it holds, but the period you're looking at, we've talked before, is one of transition. It's one of widespread debate, uncertainty about the direction of the movement. That's not the last time that happens in the Spanish anarchist movement. I mean, this is why I think that you should write several sequels to your book, that because, you know, you could, like, looking at the sort of print culture in response to, like, the CNT's repression in the 1920s, looking at print culture in response to the Civil War, when there are, you know, billions of newspapers appearing all over the place, and, you know, which is like the main forum through which, like, activists debate, like, things like collaboration in governments or not. You know, it seems like, you know, the press remains, even, you know, even despite the persistence of Soledad Obrera as a kind of, like, reference point, you know, the press still remains like this kind of, like, fundamental resource for activists. And it's, you know, as soon as they think that Soledad Obrera isn't sufficient to their purposes, or is, you know, is in a moment of it being repressed or things like that, then, you know, multiple other alternatives spring up.
I don't doubt that, and I don't think that it becomes, like, dramatically less significant. I think it just slightly becomes less the central plank of what I see as the kind of overall movement, not the sole central thing that binds anarchists together. There are other, you know, avenues for that. I think I might have to adapt my methodology a bit if I was going to go into like other periods. I tried to read literally every paper I could get my hands on, and then, yeah, in other periods that's going to get, like, completely out of control. I'm not reading every issue of Soledad Obrera. And I don't think anyone's going to pay me to. So, but no, like, reading the broad number of papers that are published that aren't Soledad Obrera, and seeing what, you know, seeing how things relate to that in future periods. Yeah, there's, you know, it's always arbitrary, you know, picking a point at which you end, and, you know, as much pragmatic as any other. And, you know, I kind of settled on one, but there's no, you know, it's artificial. It's not like the movement after was like a totally different thing that I wouldn't recognize and understand. It's just different contexts, different circumstances within and without the movement.
I mean, obviously, like, any, like, attempt to try and, like, understand history is going to be partial, and it's going to be, like, have different, you know, different emphases, some of which will be to do with bias, some of which will be to do, you know, more arbitrary or circumstantial, or to do with the kind of evidence available. But that doesn't mean that they don't, you know, it's precisely for those kinds of, like, emphases that, like, new light can get shed. And one of the things that I think is interesting about your focus on the press in particular is the way it sort of foregrounds ideology as a factor in how, like, sort of debates and developments took place on the ground. So what I mean by that is, like, sometimes you read accounts of the development of the CNT, say, that takes for granted a desire among working class people to organize themselves, and then sees, like, the anarchist content as being something that comes later. It, like, necessarily has to be injected in by, like, you know, activists to discover, like, this vehicle or, like, this field for their own kind of propaganda. So, you know, like, the CNT, like, acquires this, like, more anarchistic content in the aftermath of the First World War due to, like, these new, younger, radical anarchists coming in, influenced by the Russian Revolution, amongst perhaps other things. But I think, like, by looking at, like, the press in this way, as you do, over the period that you do, shows that, like, there isn't this just, like, blank canvas working class that organizes apolitically, instinctively, you know, without any kind of ideological considerations. You know, there's this, like, rich, you know, yes, repressed, yes, not, like, necessarily flourishing everywhere at once and things like this, but there is this, like, tradition of, like, discussing ideas. These ideas are current, they are being transmitted, they are being passed around, debated in, like, workplaces. And, you know, it's not like the case that something like, you know, an apolitical workers' movement just springs up out of nowhere with, like, a sort of blank space where ideology can be inserted. You know, like, do you see what I mean in terms of, like, how your book, like, sort of potentially counters certain narratives and understandings of the workers' movement in Spain?
I hope so. I mean, and that's one of the reasons, again, that the time frame, in a way, like we've spoken about, why doesn't it stretch on a bit more, but also why it didn't stop with kind of, it's usually seen as 1909 to 1911, the period when the CNT first articulated. Why didn't stop there? And I think it's important to have this period here, sort of 1909 to 1915, where it was up for debate what the CNT was then. Outside Catalonia, it's basically always going to be, as far as I can see anyway, it's always going to be, it's going to be tapping into those parts of the working class in Spain that have that, have a background that probably, you know, their trade was organized into anarchist affiliated types of organization that have been going on for decades. Elsewhere in Spain, outside of Catalonia, there already exists in many places a strong socialist political party and union. People have already had a choice to join that and presumably haven't. So does that mean that they're like apathetic? Probably some of them probably are. Does it mean that they're apolitical? Like in that meaning of the word, probably yes. And does that mean that like there's actually some quite a lot of working class people who have an ideological aversion to the way that the socialist movement is organized? And yes, like quite a lot. So I think when I read lots of accounts of the early years of the CNT, which are understandably focused a lot on developments in Barcelona or Catalonia, you know, more broadly, there is this discussion about how apolitical is it going to be? Is it, you know, how do they negotiate the early socialist and republican members in it? But that's because the political climate in Barcelona is quite different to those of other places in Spain. In Gijón, like, there's already a strong socialist movement, and probably those that were going to join it have done. So when the CNT becomes an alternative, it's there. And it's, you know, it's no surprise to me to see the names that have been writing into the anarchist press for the last 10 years are the people that are joining the CNT. So I don't think it's out of the blue. Obviously, the First World War and the Russian Revolution have massive impact into what the CNT is doing. But the anarchism of the CNT, I think, is there from these areas from the start.
I suppose like probably there's been a kind of lazy way of like talking about the CNT, you know, since the days of the CNT's like greatest like power and things, where it's just like, okay, this is like an anarchist organization. And like historians have felt the need to like kind of say, well, hang on, you know, that doesn't mean that you've got like 800,000 fully ideologically committed anarchists in Spain in 1919 or whatever. And so there's been a need to like sort of differentiate there. But I think there's also like too much projection in the sense of like, well, working class people are only interested in sort of meat and drink, kind of like economic issues, day-to-day survival, things like this. You know, the ideological people are exceptional, almost like just by being ideological, become uprooted and distinct from the working class as a sort of broad thing, which is like how people think about politics today, probably. But I think is not like a really unsensible way of understanding like the past necessarily. And like how people thought about their own circumstances. I mean, I first started thinking about this because I've been like studying this person, Julián Merino, who became like, well, it was a fairly like prominent mid-level activist in the movement, in the CNT and the FI, like during the Civil War and things. He went on like a propaganda mission into Navarra in the aftermath of the First World War. And he was addressing like workers because like he had like a notebook on him that was like seized by police that's like in the archives. It's quoted in a book called Vivan los Comunes. And how he's addressing workers, like according to his own notes, is very much like in anarchist terms. He's not saying, you know, listen, join the CNT because we're a more effective union that will get you higher wages, that, you know, our methods of direct action are more effective than those of the socialist union. He's saying, join the CNT for revolution so that we can get our revenge on the ruling class, so that these parasites aren't going to be living off us anymore, and so we can live a life that's completely different to the one we live in now. Okay, so you might say, okay, well, that's the period in the immediate aftermath of the Russian Revolution. It's like inspired by that kind of like moment of like revolutionary fervor. You know, maybe like he's like one of the new intake. But then when you like look into it, he's been an anarchist himself a good few years before the CNT ever had any like sort of implantation in the factory where he worked in Zaragoza. So when you think, okay, well, how do you explain that then in the absence of like these kind of organizations? Well, probably he was familiar with the press, you know, with anarchist like newspapers in the area. He had had 3 years of schooling, started work as a kid, but, you know, able to read from those 3 years of schooling. So what was available to read in Zaragoza in the early years of the 20th century, or like the turn of the century? Well, certainly anarchist material would have been one of, like, you know, one option. So, like, by foregrounding the press in the way that you do, not only do we, like, see, like, the importance of, like, these kind of networks organizationally in terms of providing continuity, but also just, like, as an insight into, like, how people thought about politics, how people thought about themselves and their own lives. And I think that that's something that has been traditionally, people are a bit maybe embarrassed about. Like, they don't want to, like, sort of acknowledge that people had, like, these, like, kind of, like, utopian or what seemed from the common sense vantage point of our own times as being, like, you know, pie in the sky kind of ideas. You know, they want to, like, sort of write them down into, like, the sort of salt of the earth kind of working class people that, like, we sort of understand as existing today, but which, you know, can't just be, like, decontextualized historically.
Just as the argument today is facile and, like, lazy and condescending, it's the same for the past. I mean, in a way, I guess because I've had my head in this period, you know, so much, in this press so much, in a way, like, the idea of someone going on a propaganda tour in over the turn of the century and talking about the workability of different tactics of particular using, that wouldn't get people going and interested. What would get people going is exactly the kind of things that you said. It's going to say, like, read the anarchist press and learn how to destroy the system that represses you and feed your children and, you know, some problematic things as well. Like, it will make your wife less, you know, belonging to the priest or, you know, like, whatever. But, like, it's that stuff that gets, it's certain, they don't talk about you'll get minor pay rise better if you join this union and follow this strategy. That is, it doesn't. And obviously, you know, okay, so then the question would be, yeah, but all right, so I'm just reading those sources. I don't know what people, but I'm talking about, you know, this is excluding Catalonia. There are about 300 papers published in this period. Very, very, very few of them aren't published by people that identify as workers and have working class jobs and are also contributed to by workers groups, you know, from all over the country. These aren't middle class activists or, like, there's a handful, you know. These are bootmakers and coopers and, you know, very few landless labourers, which is an interesting point about backgrounds and kind of who's doing that. But still, these are, you know, they're working class people who believe in this stuff and want to debate and talk about this stuff and want others to as well. And that's the language that they use. And clearly it's resonating because the largest anarchist movement in history, it comes out of this culture. I mean, I think on this subject, you know, I think, and it goes beyond the press, but for me, the press is the way to, you know, it was my way in. But someone like Tamar Kaplan's work about, you know, the anarchist cultural development in Cádiz in the 19th century is just brilliant on that, about how, you know, and also the things aren't mutually exclusive. In one paper, you could have like an article about the theoretical, how does one relate to local working class political party or something like that. And then next to that might be a poem. And then next to that might be news that someone in the pueblo down the road have called their child Kropotkin, which is an unfortunate name, you know, if your language doesn't really use K, but anyway, that's what they did. And then next to that will be, like the workers in Rio Tinto went on strike and, you know, good on them and they've stayed on strike. You know, like, it's not one or the other. These are workers and they write about working things, but they also write about why the priest is a liar and why, you know, it's great that someone's done an oceanographic expedition to the South Pacific. Like, it's, you know, it's the two things aren't that easy to just pull apart. And I think as well, it goes back to what we were saying earlier about a willingness to kind of confront limits and go beyond them, you know, within the movement at least. And I think when they're interacting with other people, no one's telling each other to, like, shut up and concentrate on the, like, this is the matter at hand and everything else. You just need to keep stum about all those kind of weird ideas you've got, and we can only talk about the. I've used the word naive, and I guess we're trying to take away any kind of negative connotations to it. I suppose it's like willingly naive or open to all kinds of stuff going into it, and acknowledging that other people in the same situation will be as well. They want to hear about that. Like if you're putting together a newspaper in Valladolid where there's a tiny workers movement and you're like a make cabinets, that seems to be one of the main occupations, you know, like a carpenter, you're an ebanista. For you to put out a paper in which you're talking about all those different things that I've been saying, like, you know, you might want to talk about free love and like the dangers of smoking tobacco, a story about why God isn't real, all within the same thing. You must assume that some people, some other people in your situation are going to want to read about that. And they do, because thousands and thousands of these papers are distributed all over Spain and beyond into Europe and the Americas. So there is at least some like actively interested working class in the idea of plurality, interests and strategies and utopias at this moment.
In terms of like landless laborers, something that I've like come across is that, you know, like if you work in a sugar mill in Zaragoza, which is like one of the industries that was helping the city, like, you know, grow, like aiding the process of industrialization and urbanization, it was still like largely dependent on harvests and on the seasons and things like that. So like if you know, the foreman would hire like day laborers for work in sugar mills, but they might be put out to like work in the harvests and things like that. So even in like cities, in like nominally urban trades that were becoming like unionized and things like that, the actual sort of extent to which those like workers were like fully urban and divorced from the sort of the dynamics of the countryside and its own like particular employment like practices is a bit blurry. And I think you do have like cases, especially like in that kind of period, of like people going back to villages as well, you know, like in certain seasons and things like that. And so I think it's kind of interesting, just because like some historians like comment on how like the anarchist movement in Spain, you know, particularly by the sort of 20s, 30s, was largely urban phenomenon, but which talked about the countryside a fair bit. You know, and they say that like, this is a paradox, you know, they don't necessarily understand the countryside, they idealize the countryside, but really they're kind of urban figures. But, you know, it's not the case that they don't have any kind of like appreciation or understanding of the countryside. For a start, a lot of them are born in like sort of rural areas and moved to the cities. But also, like, it's not necessarily like, you know, a one day to the next kind of thing that you become urban and like lose contact with, particularly in the cases where like in those kinds of cities that are still in a process of urbanization, that have like this kind of like rural periphery, which I think is like a really interesting, possibly underexplored aspect of anarchism, and that might give some insight into the way that they conceptualize like changing relations between town and the city.
That's an interesting point, because again, it's showing these kind of waves in historiography, isn't it? Because old historiography often saw anarchism as somehow intrinsic of the landless laborer, and then to go back, and it's not an easy answer, but it turns out, well, it is very blurry. And also, you know, I took a lot from anthropology from the 60s and 70s that went to, you know, places like Andalusia to look at the, you know, what life is like there. And one of the things that comes out very strongly in some of those works is, you know, we think of Andalusia is often portrayed as this very rural place and a kind of bedrock for anarchism in Spain. Well, the way that communities often work in Andalusia isn't in peasant small holdings like you would find in the north of Spain or like in France, or, you know, they are agro towns. So the definition between urban and rural is blurred there, and you absolutely would go out to work in the fields at some parts of the year, or even one day to the next. Then other days you might be a kind of odd jobsman, you know, and often it's the anarchist presence in these towns, which is clear. Who is it that's receiving the papers? It's like the barbers, it's the barman, it's the places where people congregate. And, you know, you might not see someone for a couple of months, but, you know, then they'll come into your barbershop, and it's never that sort of cut and dry as to who is this person? Are they a laborer? Are they a peasant? Are they that? It's also not really my background or approach. So, you know, I've steered away from economic determinist, you know, approaches as to who anarchists were and like, you know, where they've come from or what, you know, particular strata of the working class, because to me it seems I'd need to be looking at totally different data and sources basically to make those kind of arguments. What I'm interested in is what they were saying about, you know, themselves and the world around them.
Thanks for listening. As Danny mentioned at the start, listeners in the US can buy the paperback from the AK Press website, which is akpress.org. And you can find it by searching for either Print Culture or James Michael Yeoman. The book will be available in the UK from your local Radical bookseller from spring 2023. And I'll be doing a few public events in the UK in early 2023, so far in Manchester, Leeds and Sheffield. Keep an eye on our Twitter page at @ABCDannyandJim, where we will post details when they are confirmed. I'm also keen to do some more in-person events, so if you're listening somewhere else in the UK and you have something in mind for your local bookshop, reading group, zine collective, or anything really, do get in touch via our email, abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to our newsletter at abcwithdannyandjim.substack.com. The podcast music is Stealing Orchestra and Rafael Denocio, Gente de Miña Terra. The podcast logo is an adapted version of the Left Book Club logo. And the image in this episode is a box full of copies of my book, which I received from AK Press, which features the cover art designed by Isidro Pergamino, who you can find on Instagram under Ave Cosmica Prints. And I've put a link to that account in the notes to this show, and do check him out because he's really good. Love and solidarity. Until next time.